was all about whistleblowers. You never hear, what happened to the whistleblower? They go, because they've been discredited. What happened to the informant? And where is the IG? Why didn't the IG read the letter, read the transcript? He could have gotten it, I guess, I assume. I would have declassified it for him if I had to do that. Why didn't he read this and then see that the whistleblower's account was totally different than the letter? Then he would have said, oh, there's no problem here. The whistleblower gave a false account. Now you have to say, well, do we have to protect somebody that gave a false account? You know, these whistleblowers, they have them like they're angels.
President Trump speaking today during a cabinet meeting today ahead of a busy week in the Ukraine inquiry. The acting ambassador to Ukraine, Bill Taylor, set to testify tomorrow. He wrote in a text message that it would be, quote, crazy to link military assistance to help a political campaign. Other State Department and Defense Department officials are scheduled to meet with lawmakers later in the week. And some, though, are defying subpoenas. Some, such as outgoing Energy Secretary Rick Perry. Well, it's Monday, so Jessica Levinson is here to help us make sense of the latest on the inquiry. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal Eagle. Hi there.
Happy Monday.
Wow. And it begins again. OK, so Mick Mulvaney was on Fox yesterday trying to repair the damage from last week's. Here he is. Let's take a listen.
It's legitimate to tie the aid to corruption. It's legitimate to tie the aid to foreign aid from other countries. That's what I was talking about with the three. Can I see how people took that the wrong way? Absolutely. But I never said there was a quid pro quo because there isn't.
OK, so here is that exchange that where he actually said that last week.
But to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happens as well.
We do that all the time with foreign policy.
OK, so there's all this debate, this back and forth on quid pro quo. Is that actually necessary? The quid pro quo, the proving of a quid pro quo to establish some kind of bad behavior?
No, this has been like much ado about a quid pro quo without needing to, frankly. So what you could have is a president of the United States saying, hi, president of Ukraine, I would really like help on blank that will help me in my next presidential election, in my reelection. You don't need to tie that to, and therefore will only give you your military aid. Just the solicitation of a thing of value from a foreign government that will help you in your election alone could be a federal election law violation. And then kind of step number two, let's say there is a quid pro quo. That doesn't necessarily mean that there was illegality. So I think it's been really beside the point that we keep focusing on whether or not there's an exchange. I mean, Mick Mulvaney's right that when you're talking about military aid, I mean, this is the most precious resource. It's taxpayer dollars. You don't want to misuse it. What Mick Mulvaney is saying is we wanted to make sure it was a place that was free of corruption. They would use the money well. But what Mick Mulvaney previously said and what the summary of the transcript said is it was President Trump saying, you want your military aid? I want my help for either personal political gain in the 2016, looking back at the 2016 election or looking forward at the 2020 election. That's different. You can't tie military aid to do something that's helpful for me in my political campaign.
Right. Interesting that Mulvaney does not mention the Joe Biden part of all this. So he's mentioning the 2016 election, the Democratic server, as some kind of, you know, this has been discredited, by the way, as some kind of evidence of political corruption in Ukraine and therefore it being legitimate to withhold military aid while that investigation continues.
Exactly. So layer upon layer. One, we have a request to look into a discredited conspiracy theory related to the 2016 campaign. Two, we have Mick Mulvaney, I have to think, not by accident saying, we were looking back at what previously happened. We're not looking forward to a reelection because what the summary of the transcript shows is that President Trump keeps saying, okay, and let me just remind you, I keep hearing all these things about Hunter Biden, and that's very different. It's clear that Joe Biden is going to be a political opponent. It's clear that that is about a political election.
And again, doesn't have to be a quid pro quo for that to be wrong.
Exactly.
Okay. So meanwhile, all this testimony, including this week's testimony, behind closed doors, what are the advantages and disadvantages of that?
So, I mean, they're both political and legal. So behind closed doors means that Democrats get to talk to witnesses without having to worry about essentially grandstanding, without having to worry about how it sounds to the public. It also means that they don't have to worry that witnesses are conferring with each other and making sure that their stories line up in the same way.
But couldn't they do that anyway?
You could, but it's somewhat, if you think about like cheating on a test, it's the difference between walking out and saying, here were the questions and here's what I said, versus here's my paper, read from it word for word. So there is a slight difference, or I would say a significant difference there. But for
and
the
they are under oath.
They are right. Under oath. But we know that people can use conditional language when they're under oath to essentially provide themselves with escape hatches. Now, for Democrats, the cons are that it looks like, well, what do you have to hide? This is incredibly important to the American people. It's the most important thing, arguably, you can do, which is to remove an elected president. So why shouldn't we hear from everyone? If you really want to tell us a story about wrongdoing, let's hear it now. Let's not hear it filtered later when you decide in drips and drabs to provide us with that information.
And then what happens to people like Rick Perry who decide I am not going to participate?
Yeah. So this is, I mean, this is such a big and important question, which is we used to think of subpoenas not like, you know, an invitation to come over for a summer barbecue where it was, oh, maybe I will, maybe I won't. It's a legally binding document. So we're seeing the Constitution kind of stretch and figure out where is it going to break when Congress uses its oversight authority. They're going through impeachment inquiry. They're subpoenaing witnesses. And the witnesses are saying, no, thank you. I mean, what you could do is Congress basically has two doors. One is they can use their inherent powers of contempt. They don't do that very often. They could hold Rick Perry in contempt. That means basically money damages or trying to force him into jail. They could go to a federal judge, more likely, and say, we issued a subpoena. This is under our impeachment powers in the Constitution. We need him to respond. This wasn't just like a, you know, a wish and a hope and a prayer. And so then you would wait for a federal judge. And I think in this case that members of Congress stand on very firm ground in saying we need people to respond to these subpoenas.
Although couldn't Perry and the others just wait it out, just continue to refuse and go through the process and it kind of plays out?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that politically is the name of the game. Mm-hmm. It's also important to remember there's a difference between I won't show up, I won't respond to the subpoena, and I will show up, but I'm going to assert privilege. So I'll be there, but I'm not going to say a lot.
But I won't say anything, the fifth and all that. Okay, let's switch gears to a ruling in Florida last week. A judge ruled the state cannot prevent ex-felons from voting, even if they cannot afford the fines that they owe. What does that mean?
So this is a really important ruling. A few years ago, the people of Florida voted and they said, if you are a certain type of ex-felon, then you can have your voting rights restored. Why are we talking about this? Because it's Florida when it comes to the presidential election. And so what the Republican-led legislature did is they said, we need to clarify what the people just passed. And so what we're going to say is, sure, you can have your rights to restored if you're a felon, but not if you still owe court fines and fees. And what the judge did is he said, no, that looks like an unconstitutional poll tax. And so if you can't pay, then that can't be a reason that you don't get to vote. But if you can pay and just choose not to, that can be a reason. But this is just a preliminary injunction. This isn't the end of the story. But it really does just kind of have flashing lines of looks like a poll tax, walks like a poll tax, you know, sounds like a poll tax.
Right. And assume that most of these ex-felons would vote on the Democratic side if they are allowed to vote.
Absolutely no coincidence that Democrats are in favor of this, Republicans are against it, because everything in life has law and politics all intertwined.
Okay, and that's why you're here.
Thank you.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, our regular Monday Legal Eagle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why Canada's charismatic leader Justin Trudeau is fighting for his political life. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Justin Trudeau, what happened? Not long ago, he was being fawned over by the left for his youthful charisma and his progressive politics, the anti-Trump, if you will, an Obama-like bastion of progressive liberalism when he rose to power about 4 years ago. Even President Obama himself endorsed him over the weekend. But now, Trudeau is fighting for his political life. Elections are being held today, and Trudeau could lose to a conservative, the leader of the opposition, a man named Andrew Scheer. Well, Dan Belevsky joins us now from Montreal. He's a Canada correspondent for The New York Times. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so I'll just pose the question again. What happened? He was really the sunshine boy for a while, and now lots of clouds.
As you mentioned, I mean, Justin Trudeau was this glittering symbol for progressive liberalism, you know, on the global stage at a time of rising populism. He came to power in 2015 as this transformational character, and he was also the consummate prime minister of the Instagram era. You know, his shirtless jogs captured global headlines, along with his colorful socks and his gravity-defying yoga poses. But he's been battered recently by two things. One, he was accused of bullying his attorney general in a corporate corruption case. She's a woman and she's Indigenous, and he had fashioned himself as a feminist. And the second thing was that just before the campaign had even barely begun, these images emerged of him wearing brown and blackface, mm-hmm. including a very damaging video in which he was seen in blackface wearing an afro and sticking his tongue out.
So lots of news about that, and he went on an apology tour. How are Canadians feeling about that whole incident now?
I mean, I think for the most part, many Canadians feel that the blackface incidents happened 20 years ago in a different cultural context, and many people have forgiven him for that. But I think in combination with the corporate corruption scandal and the feeling that he's sort of this sanctimonious moralizer who then was caught out, people are not feeling very enthusiastic about him at the moment.
We'll talk more about that corruption scandal. It involves a company called SNC-Lavalin, right?
Exactly. So it involved a company called SNC-Lavalin, which is a Quebec company. It's an iconic company in the Quebec corporate sector, engineering company. It was involved in corporate corruption on an epic scale in Libya. And in order to save jobs, Justin Trudeau essentially wanted to settle the charges against the company instead of it going to trial, which would have resulted potentially in the company being banned from competing for years to come in getting government contracts.
Well, why was he trying to protect this company?
The company employs thousands of people, and his argument was that if it went to trial and the company was not allowed to compete for contracts, government contracts, then thousands of Canadian jobs could be at stake.
Okay. And then so he was accused of bullying the AG to reduce the charges to civil rather than criminal.
He basically was accused of pressuring the attorney general to try and come up with a settlement so that it didn't go to trial. And she accused him of, you know, trying to interfere in the judiciary and politicizing the judicial process.
So how badly was he damaged politically by this?
He was very badly damaged politically. In 2015, he had come to power, you know, promising a new sunny way of doing politics, of being a progressive, of being an internationalist and a rules-based kind of leader, and, you know, to be seen to have tried to influence a judicial case was not at all well received by the Canadian public.
But what else? The economy, immigration, things like that, things that people, at least on this side of the border, really care about. Is that something that Canadians are worried about?
Canadians are worried about many things, but actually the most seminal issue that's come up in this election is the environment. For the first time since the Second World War, young people under the age of 35 are a bigger chunk of voters than baby boomers, and the key issue they care about is the environment. Recently, hundreds of thousands of Canadians took to the streets to march against global warming, and Trudeau has made this one of his signature policies. I mean, this is really the issue that's dominated the campaign.
So you would think that he would do well with that group?
he could do well, but because of the scandals buffeting him, the blackface and the corporate corruption scandal, the young people who came out in droves in 2015 to elect him may stay home. You know, there's a lot of voter apathy. People are feeling disillusioned, and he just is not capturing the public imagination in the way that he did the last time.
So pivot to Andrew Scheer, who is his main opponent. This guy's pretty conservative, right? He's anti-abortion, anti-gay marriage.
He is sort of like a Canadian Alex P. Keaton type, you know, someone who would be like a young Republican in the American context. He is a social conservative. He's a career politician who entered, you know, Parliament when he was 25. You know, his work experience really consisted of a short-lived stint in an insurance office. And he's socially conservative, and that conservatism is out of step with many Canadians, you know, in a country where, you know, there's the right to abortion and same-sex marriage is allowed. He has made disparaging comments about same-sex marriage, and he's pro-life. So a lot of Canadians are unenthused by him, and some people see him as kind of a young fogey who lacks charisma, in contrast to Mr. Trudeau, who, despite all of his problems, is still a great campaigner.
And yet they're running neck and neck in the polls, right?
Yeah, they're running neck and neck in the polls.
How do you account for that?
I think the main explanation is that Canadians are feeling very disillusioned with politics. You know, part of it is that Trudeau has been battered by scandal, as we mentioned. But part of it is, I think, it's just a general disillusionment with politics. People are just fed up, and Trudeau is just not capturing their imagination in the same way that that he did before. But at the same time, many see him as the least worst option because they have very little ardor for Mr. Scheer, the Conservative leader.
And do people outside of Canada even know who Andrew Scheer is?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I think one thing that most Canadians will acknowledge is that because Trudeau is, you know, this telegenic, charismatic character, you know, he's been called the internet's boyfriend, you know, this sort of Canadian Prince Charming, Canada has punched above its weight on the global stage by the sheer virtue of his optics. I mean, you may recall that when he met President Trump in the Oval Office, you know, they had that famous handshake, and a lot of other leaders had balked under the handshake, and Trudeau stood his ground and kind of outmaneuvered him. So the optics of Justin Trudeau on the international stage have been very strong, and people know him. Whereas Andrew Scheer, you know, is a little-known character in Canada, never mind outside of Canada.
Yeah. Okay, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Dan Bilewski is Canada correspondent for The New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Someone else losing power right now? Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He announced today he cannot form a governing majority. He's been trying to do that for about a month now. So his rival, Benny Gantz, will have his turn to try to do that. And if he can't, well, yet another election. Here to tell us more is Aaron David Miller, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former Middle East advisor. Welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure, Madeline.
Okay, well, tell us what happened today.
Well, predictably, now for the second time since April, the longest governing prime minister in the history of the state of Israel, surpassing David Ben-Gurion this past July, has failed to be able to put together a government. This has a certain operational consequence, but it also carries, seems to me, a consequence within Netanyahu's own Likud party. You know, in Israeli politics, the old saw says that you could be dead or dead and buried. And in this case, I think Mr. Netanyahu, while down, is not entirely out. He remains caretaker prime minister. If new elections are held a third time, they probably won't be until March. But in the interim, the mandate will return to the president of Israel, Mr. Rivlin, who's already decided to convey it on Mr. Gantz, the head of the Blue and White Party. He'll have 28 days to form a government. Right now, unless there's a deal unbeknownst to any of us, Mr. Gantz may well have no easy path toward putting a government together. He would then return the mandate to the president, and the president would then, if in fact there is any member of Knesset, any member who stands a chance of putting together a government, he or she would have 21 days in order to do that. There's no precedent for that eventuality.
Yeah.
And if they fail at that, then you're going to new elections.
Wow. Okay, so Bibi is dead but not dead and buried is what you're saying.
That's my view.
But it does seem to be quite a big blow to him. He, you know, he, as you say, is the longest serving prime minister and enjoyed a lot of popularity, it seems, until recently. Why is he unable to form a government?
I mean, I think it on the micro level, it has to do with the fact that one party, Mr. Lieberman's party, which has 8 mandates, and Lieberman was an ally, an acolyte of Mr. Netanyahu.
And he's ultra-right.
Right. A Russian, 61-year-old Russian immigrant from Moldova, very smart, has a constituent base of Russian pensioners, running on a platform of secularization of Israeli politics and Israeli society, very anti-Arab, very controversial among Israel's Arab citizens, has 8 mandates. And he prevented Mr. Netanyahu, as you recall, in April, from putting together a government, and what might have been a natural coalition ally in any other set of circumstances has proven to be a huge roadblock. And it's all a question of the math in the Israeli parliament, Knesset. No party has ever had a majority. You need a coalition. And Mr. Netanyahu, without Mr. Lieberman, Mr. Netanyahu could not do it.
So what does Lieberman want from Netanyahu?
Well, the question is whether or not this is still some sort of game that Mr. Lieberman is playing, or whether or not he's genuinely decided that Netanyahu has to go. And a lot of it is getting even for being dismissed at least twice by Mr. Netanyahu and not taken seriously as Mr. Lieberman believes he should have. Or, alternatively, not just kingmaker, Avigdor Lieberman believes that he has a political future that could make him prime minister. Mm. The fact is, he has tough security credentials. He's one of the few Israeli politicians who has been both Minister of Foreign Affairs and Minister of Defense. And he has a sustainable domestic base. Now, the real question for the next 28 days, Madeline, is whether or not Mr. Gantz has an option. He has 57 seats with 13 Arab mandates, Israeli citizens of Israel. There's no precedent for a coalition formally including inside the government Israeli Arabs. It would be unprecedented. I would argue welcome, but it may be a bridge too far for Mr. Lieberman and other Israeli parties. So the question, I think, is whether or not there are any circumstances under which Lieberman would be willing to join the blue and white, if that's the case.
Blue and white being Benny Gantz's party.
Right.
But what you're saying sounds like Lieberman is the one with all the power here.
Indeed he is. He's the, I think, the swing factor the coalition and or king maker. It seems to me, and we'll have to wait this out, that on the surface, the divisions, differences between Mr. Lieberman and the blue and white party, Mr. Gantz, are not all that great. It would be an extraordinary development, though, for the first time in 11 years, though, Madeline, someone other than Benjamin Netanyahu is now charged with forming the next Israeli government. You alluded to the blow to Mr. Netanyahu. That is, other than indictment and conviction, that is his worst nightmare.
So what about that, though? If he is no longer prime minister, what happens to the criminal cases?
Well, he is caretaker prime minister, and from his own vantage point, it's better for him to be prime minister in a caretaker government than to be out of power. So he'll do everything he possibly can to preserve his unity and cohesion within the Likud party. The attorney general is expected to pronounce on an indictment, yes or no, and on which charge probably within the next 6 weeks, certainly by December 1st. So, and again, according to Israeli law, you do not have to resign if you are indicted, only if you are convicted. So Mr. Netanyahu believes, particularly if they drop the bribery charge of the three, fraud and breach of trust being the other two charges, if they drop the bribery charge, which is the most important and most consequential, it may well be that Mr. Netanyahu would be able, with Mr. Gantz, to return to some sort of national unity government. It gets really complicated. There's a reason most of the U.S. media isn't following this. It's just too complicated.
And it's complicated, but it is important for geopolitics.
It is. It is indeed.
All right. Aaron David Miller, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment and a former State Department Middle East advisor. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, the sale of the Ennis House, the famous Frank Lloyd Wright-designed home in Los Feliz, sold for millions of dollars to a mystery buyer. We'll talk about that and how new technology has created more anxiety over tipping.
Bottom line, with the apps or the iPad and Square, there are often many times that you're tipping out of pressure, and that is not the reason to tip.
How to tip when your barista flips that screen and waits and watches. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to talk about tipping now and that awkward moment when after you've paid for your coffee or your ice cream or your poke bowl and the employee turns that iPad-like screen towards you and it asks how much you'd like to tip, you know, 20, 25, 30% or no tip. That moment is stressful. The employee is right there, maybe staring at you, maybe kind of looking away. People are behind you. What do you do? Thankfully, Diane Gotsman is here. She's an etiquette expert and owner of the Protocol School of Texas. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Madeline. Yes, that is a really awkward moment, and I think we have all encountered it. Even when you were talking about it, I can feel the feeling.
I know. I just feel like, oh, I don't know what to do, because of course you want to tip, but you know, how much
right.
do you tip on a $2 cup of coffee?
So I think that knowledge is power, and just because they swing that iPad around and they are watching you, and sometimes they don't. They look away because they too feel awkward or know that you're feeling awkward. You should not feel obligated to leave a tip. So you're not obligated to leave a tip for a takeout order. You're not obligated to leave a tip if you walk up to the counter for a $3 or $4 cup of coffee.
You know, you mentioned the awkwardness, and it's not just us on this side of the counter who feel awkward. It's also the workers. We sent our producer out to talk to a few around here at a cafe and other places, and this is what one person told her.
Gratuities are like, you know, it's if someone wants to do it. Like, whether or not you feel you deserve it doesn't really matter. It's like, you know, someone doesn't want to tip you, that's their prerogative. Like, so when you're kind of forcing it upon them, I feel like it almost guilts them into tipping because they have to say no. And they're looking you right in the eye while they're doing it. So I feel like that's what it is.
Do you ever, like, look away?
Yeah, I try not to make it awkward. I try to move to the side, do something else.
Okay, so everybody feels weird in that situation. It's not just us.
Yes, absolutely, because they know how we are feeling, and they are on the other end of that sometimes. You know, they also take the role of the consumer, you know, in different situations.
Okay, so, but here you are in the... You know, you're looking at this screen and it says 20%, 25%, 30% or no tip. Like, who's
right.
really going to do no tip? Because then you really feel like you're the jerk.
So I think that, again, knowing that it's not an obligation is going to be part of it. You don't want to be cheap and you aren't cheap. And remember, they're feeling awkward as well. So if you walk up to the counter, they provide you a very quick service. It takes less than, you know, 10 seconds and you're on your way. If you're strong enough, you know, it really becomes a battle of strength. If you can hit no tip, hit no tip. If you decide that you want to leave them 30% and walk away and let it ruin the next 15 minutes of your day or talk about it for another 2 weeks, then it really isn't worth it. Really and truly, unless it is a service they're providing. I don't feel like you should feel guilty. Now, I am an advocate for tips. Please don't think that I don't think they should be, you know, hospitality people should not be tipped. But when you get into a cab and you take a cab ride and, you know, the standard is the standard. It's 15%, you know, 15 to 20%. So if they're giving you a 30, you know, 35 option, stick with the 15, you know, if that's what you're comfortable with, or 20.
But you say that it's for service. We're in a service economy. So almost everything is a service. So it's hard to know when to tip and when not to tip. And earlier you said you don't tip on takeout. I always tip on takeout because I assume they're preparing the package for me. They're actually working. I mean, they're not maybe coming to the table and clearing the table and all that, but they're still doing a fair amount of work. So I do tip on takeout orders.
Oh, see, I think that's very nice. And so takeout, you know, if you walk up and you pick it up and they have prepared, you know, bags and bags of food for you. And in your case, I'm sure it's not bags and bags unless you're having a party.
But, you know, no, it's bags and bags.
But if you walk up to the counter and say, I'd like to take a muffin to go, and they put it in a bag, and that's what I meant. They put it in a bag and you're off on your way.
That's something else,
You decide, right? I do believe takeout and delivery and the drivers should be tipped. So do what you feel is right. And if you don't want to tip on when you walk up and they hand you a muffin or, you know, here's an example. I purchased a T-shirt the other day, and it was a T-shirt. It was a piece of clothing, but it was at a restaurant. They flipped the iPad over, and then they wanted, you know, and of course the option was to tip. And I had that same feeling you were describing, and I hit no tip because I was buying a piece of clothing. Yeah. This person was getting paid by the hour.
That
so, you know,
seems
think
a little
this through
strange.
Quickly. Right.
But it does go into the whole conundrum of what tipping is, because you're supposed to be tipping for good service, but in reality, we're tipping to avoid public humiliation.
Well, yes and no. Sometimes when you're pressure tipping, you're avoiding public humiliation, but really a tip is for good service. And that's where we all should not be confused. If we're tipping because the person behind us is watching us, we're tipping for the wrong reason. If we're tipping because we don't want to tip, but we think someone may be looking at us, wrong reason. If we're tipping because we're confident that we're doing the right thing, that's the right reason to tip. And it should be fair. You know, if you're skipping a tip because you just are cheap, that's a different story.
Okay, one more thing. Do you tip on the final total or do you tip on the pre-tax total?
Well, the protocol is that you would tip pre-tax. The reality is it's just easier to round up. 20% of a bill is easier to figure out when you're in line than 15% pre-tax, carry the two. You know.
Yeah, and who's that person who does that? Come on.
Right.
I mean, it's not that much more money. All right.
Right, exactly.
Diane, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Diane Gotsman, she's an etiquette expert and owner of the Protocol School of Texas. Frank Lloyd Wright's Ennis House. It is an architectural tour de force. 27,000 beige textile blocks. It looks like a Mayan temple. It's perched high above Los Feliz in the Hollywood Hills with a $1 million view of downtown. Well, $18 million to be exact. That's what the Ennis House just sold for. It set a record for the priciest sale ever of a Frank Lloyd Wright designed house. Adrian Scott Fine joins me now. He leads preservation efforts at the LA Conservancy. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Well, just describe this house for people who aren't familiar with it, because it really is a stunner.
Sure. It's this Mayan revival style textile block, really mansion sitting on the top of the hill in Los Feliz that anybody driving through there would see it. Very recognizable for its architecture, and one of the probably a handful of houses that Frank Lloyd Wright designed in this kind of textile block architecture with these heavy concrete blocks that really define it as a very heavy-looking house in terms of its overall character.
And built in 1924, I understand, for a retailer named Charles Ennis.
And his wife, Mabel, yes.
And his wife, Mabel. And owned until very recently by the supermarket magnate Ron Burkle, right?
Yes, just recently changed hands.
And who did he sell it to?
I'm not sure if we can disclose that, but it's going to be turned into or back into a single-family residence. So the new owners plan to live there, raise their daughters there, which it's been a while since it's been a full-time residence, and that's what was always intended to be.
So one family will live in this?
Yes.
And it won't be open to the public at all?
There'll still be opportunity to see the house on limited access throughout the year. The Conservancy holds a preservation or conservation easement on the house, and it does require some public access. So there will always be opportunities for the public to experience it, just be limited throughout the year.
So it's had some problems, some structural and maintenance problems, as many of these Frank Lloyd Wright properties end up having. What has your organization done to help maintain it or restore it, and what did the previous owner, Burkle, do?
Sure. In the mid-90s, due to the Northridge earthquake and then certainly during the rains of the mid-2000s, that's when the building really started to show signs of serious decline and deterioration. It prompted its listing on America's 11 Most Endangered Historic Places. And so our organization has been involved since then and earlier. But one of the things that we did, as I was mentioning before, we took a conservation easement to ensure that the building's protected. So any changes or proposals to make alterations to the building in the future come through us. It's also a city landmark. So there's review mechanisms in place to protect it. The last owner, Mr. Burkle, did a lot of work, long neglected work that needed to be done to really tighten up the house. It had always suffered from, as many Frank Lloyd Wright houses do, from water. Mm-hmm. And so he really remedied a lot of those issues and restored some long missing elements like the chauffeur's quarters, had seen a lot of changes over the years. So he really brought back those features as part of his work.
I love that it has chauffeur's quarters.
Yeah,
this was built before the crash of 29.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's quite lovely chauffeur's quarters, actually.
And it's been used as a filming spot, like for Blade Runner, movies like that.
Yeah, absolutely. For many people, they know it from that film or a much earlier film, The House on Haunted Hill, or other people know it as the place where Angel, the vampire, lived from the Buffy the Vampire Slayer series.
So the new owners won't be able to go in and, like, rehab it and make it, you know, kind of modern in any way, right? They have to stick with the original look.
Right. It's a very detailed conservation easement to ensure that the building's protected both inside and out. And every indication we have from the new owners is they love the house as it is, and they want to live in it and really experience it and are thrilled to be able to have that opportunity.
Well, lucky them.
Yeah, absolutely. If only we all could be so lucky, for sure.
Exactly. Adrian Scott Fine from the LA Conservancy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, new music with our own Anthony Valadez. Get your Shazam ready. That's next on Press Play. You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, every Monday we bring you new music. Today, Anthony Valadez is here. He's a DJ here on KCRW, and you can hear his shows Saturdays from 2 to 4 in the afternoon and Sundays from 3 to 6. Hello.
Hello, Madeline.
How are you?
I'm great. It's so nice to hang here with you and see you.
It's so nice to see you because
likewise.
It's not on the weekend.
Exactly. It's
okay.
Fun to come in here on a Monday.
I know, it is. It's a little crazy in here.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you brought some new music today. The first track is called Big Girls by
Masego. Big Girls Need Love Too, and Masego has created the anthem for this cut. I love it because it's got a nice groove, and there's a lot of sexual innuendos. And I was kind of nervous about playing this on KCRW.
On a Monday.
Well, but you know
or
what?
On any day.
We got to push the boundaries. It's a new era. We got to be daring.
Okay, but let's just hope the FCC's not.
No, it's clean and it's safe.
Okay,
and so therefore, I play it and I love it. And Masego's just such a great talent.
Okay, let's hear.
Bring that back, you put your hands in there. Just like that, yeah, you're famous in there. Do that, and make it rain over here. Happy birthday, cause you're quaking over here. It's getting wild over here. It's getting loud over here. A big crowd over here. Get the first day, cause you're killing over here. Face down.
Face down.
Face down.
Face down.
Okay, ladies, get your weight up. That's what he says there.
Yeah, he's encouraging, you know, just eating. And I mean, when you think about...
I'm done for that.
Me too. I mean, live, be you. Yeah. Not everybody's a supermodel like you and I.
Exactly what I was going to say.
Be you, do you.
Okay, well, tell us more about him. Who is he?
Miss Ego's a multi-instrumentalist. Plays the sax, drums, keys, obviously a vocalist, has collaborated with the likes of Sir, Goldlink, Jazzy Jeff, poet Saul Williams, FKJ, and it's just part of this movement out of Virginia that's just creating new sounds, blending. He likes to call himself or his style trap house jazz, and I love that. He's not in one category.
What's the jazz part?
He plays the sax, and he throws in that Kenny G vibe.
All right. Excellent. Okay, let's hear another one. This one's called You and I. It's by a Norwegian singer named Jacob Ogawa.
Only 21 years old.
Really?
Yeah, out of Norway. Sonically, I just love how bright this song is. And to me, his aesthetic is very similar to a VHS tape. When I listen to him, I envision static and just the 80s aesthetic. But again, only 21 years old.
So he doesn't know from the 80s.
No, he's definitely nothing. But also, it's, you know, he's been putting music out for 2 years and he's starting to get this momentum. And I love that. Jacob Ogawa. Check him out.
So meanwhile, you... Mm-hmm. You're not just DJing here at KCRW. You've got all these other projects. And tell us about this thing you're doing with Chicago Music.
Oh, okay. So I just finished this four-episode podcast on the history of music in Chicago, dating back to the Great Migration and dealing with how, you know, what we watch in the news regarding Chicago and the violence, we hear all these negative things. But I was really inspired by this new wave of creatives like Chance the Rapper, who does a lot of philanthropy, a songstress, MC rapper by the name of No Name, who started a book club all based out of Chicago. And we talked to local representatives, community activists, folks dealing with migration. We dealt with folks in the jazz scene, folks who work with Chance the Rapper, and just talked about the roots of how this came about. And also the city of the history of corruption that it's built on.
Oh, yeah.
Is wow. Mind blowing. But it's great to see this next generation of creatives, you know, inspire new kids and give hope and provide optimism in Chicago.
And where do you hear this podcast?
This is going to be a 4-piece episode on TuneIn forthcoming. I'll definitely stop by and drop that delivery date and let you know about
okay,
that. But
cool.
We just finished production. I'm excited.
Oh, that sounds awesome. Yeah. Okay, so back to your new music that you're playing here in KCRW. What's next?
Let's keep it in Chicago. This is Jamie Branch. She's a free jazz trumpeter. She had an addiction to heroin for 10 years. And now in lieu of her craving of heroin, she's put that energy into music. And she put out this amazing record that just is mind-blowing. She's on the forefront of Chicago jazz. And she has this great quote. She moved to New York and she said, I had to leave Chicago to New York so that I could listen to Chicago.
Hmm.
And she's just so inspiring and just... Check her out, Jamie Branch.
Okay, let's listen to this track. What's it called?
Nuevo Rockero Estéreo.
Perfect.
Thank you.
That's her playing the trumpet there.
That is. That's her. You know, it's funny bringing it back to Chicago. I spent 2 weeks there kind of documenting the current music scene. And there's a real grit in Chicago and the way they talk. And I've seen a few documentaries with her online. And she has that. And she has this great line where she says, I've been told a lot to shut up, but with the trumpet, she feels like she can say whatever she wants and she can get louder and louder. And you definitely hear it all over that music. And I'm like, that is Chicago as it gets.
That is great. Well, yeah. The trumpet, it's not a subtle, quiet instrument.
Exactly. It's like a punch.
Basically saying, here I am.
Mm-hmm. Look at me.
Okay, so that's Jamie Branch. Finally, you brought in Wesley Bright and the Honeytones. Tell us about them.
I love this song so much. I just discovered it. It's been on for about a little less than a year. The band is based out of Akron, Ohio. And I just found out that Wesley Bright is actually a beekeeper. And that's kind of his daytime gig.
Oh.
And I was like, wow. And then when you hear this voice.
Well, hence the Honeytones.
Exactly. But I find that with creatives, there's always inspiration from day gigs into your music. And I'm always inspired by musicians and artists that have day gigs and then travel the world at night or when they have free time during their vacations. And just, I mean, this song is going to put a smile on your face. Trust me. And it's about heartbreak. How great is that?
That puts a smile on your face?
It's the duality of life. It's duality of life, man. I love it.
Okay, let's hear it.
I'm not saying I'm a perfect man, but it's true I've done all that I can to keep you happy and satisfied. And wash away all those tears you have cried, but I'm crazy, crazy.
Sounds so happy to say you don't want me.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've all been through that in our lives with rejection. And when you can find that soundtrack that kind of eases things and you like this becomes your anthem from heartbreak. I love it, you know?
It is a perennial in pop music.
Yeah. Do you have your go-to song, Madeline?
When to cry to?
Yeah.
Like I put it on to cry to?
Go for it.
I can't even think of one.
I got mine. I'll let you think. Sarah McLachlan, Adia. Because we are born innocent. Forgive me, Adia. Anyways, don't tell nobody I said that. This isn't going to air, is it?
Yeah, it is. I would say anything Joni Mitchell.
Mm.
She's always singing in a minor key.
Mm. Good observation.
It's just sad to listen to.
But it's healing.
Healing, and I love it.
And that's what we need
to get in touch with that side.
Exactly. And in 2019, music does heal, and I'm a big advocate for that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, so we talked about your Chicago
podcast.
Project. Mm-hmm. KCRW, you're here on the weekends. What do you do during the week?
I surf. I walk my dog, Smedley the Frenchie. I also DJ often across LA. I have a residency at Skyspace in downtown LA. Friday nights at Townhouse in Venice. And I've been known, the people call me Turn Up Tony. But I left him at home. Today you got Vibey Valadez.
Vibey Valadez.
Yeah.
So you like the alliteration.
I do. It's cool. What would be your pseudo DJ name, Madeline?
I had one.
What is it?
You know what it is.
I know. I want you to say it.
You always want
Come
me to
on.
Say it.
Say it.
All right. I'll say it. Madam Bum.
Love it.
It's like a trumpet.
Love it.
Anthony Valadez, a.k.a. Turn Up Tony, a.k.a.
Vibey Valadez. I got more. I got so many
aliases. AKAs. Yeah. You can hear him on the weekends here on KCRW. Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you, Madeline.
Big warehouse with the chains in the mirror. Fender guitars and they hang in there. Ladies at large, you look amazing there. It's a birthday, got the panties in there. Hit up the bride with the bangs in there. Hit up the
Michelle Alloy.
I'm only referring AKA to you as Madam Bomb now, forever and always.
I was afraid
from this
of
day
that.
Forward.
I was afraid of that.
Fierce confirmed. We had a lot of feedback today about tipping, iPad tipping.
Oh, yeah.
People are up in arms about it,
apparently. That's a topic that will never die.
I know. Tammy Smith says that she had the same issue getting macarons yesterday. She picked them up, the guy bagged them, and then literally watched over me as I paid on the iPad. She did not tip, she says. Victoria Byer says it's expensive to live in the city, but tipping is for services, and that to me means multiple trips to my table, an hour more torturing my hair or muscular tissue, or preparing my cocktail. Lauren Valencia, it's not awkward, it's super easy, and none of us carry cash anymore. Oh man, I could keep going. Carrie Schmidt-Spear says, I use the custom feature and leave the usual $1 or whatever, especially when making a small purchase. I also use the feature in most circumstances, certainly for takeout. Colin Davis says it's slightly easier and a bit more formalized than the tip jar, but what is the actual etiquette for tipping counter service versus table service?
That's a good one. An open question.
I know.
Cannot be resolved.
No.
How about no tipping ever? What about that?
Well, that was what he said at the end. I would love to do away with tipping. So
okay.
He's got the answer.
All right. Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. Here's a tip. I'll see you tomorrow.